Recorded live in the Phantasmo Lounge, high atop the John Agar Building in beautiful downtown Chesapeake, it's Phantasmo After Dark with your host, Commodore Tony Mercer and Rob Floyd. Our topic tonight, Phantom of the Paradise.
Ahoy, Rob.
Ahoy, Commodore.
I've got my Commodore hat.
I can see that. That's why I saluted you, and everyone else out there should do too.
Thank you very much.
Right on. Now, before we get into tonight's topic, maybe we should mention the fact that Monster Fest 12 just happened. 11? 12? What was it? 12 just happened.
It was 11.
It's 11. Monster Fest 11 just... See, I'm still lack of sleep. I still don't know what I'm talking about. Monster Fest 11 just happened, and it was a great success. Great attendance, bigger attendance than we've had in the past. Great guests, the horror host, panels, lots of vendors, more than we've had in the 11 previous ones. And everybody said they had a good time. I hope they weren't lying. And we're already looking forward and kicking around ideas for Monster Fest 12 next year, which will be Dr. Mad Blood's 40th anniversary, incidentally, and maybe we'll have a few surprises. So that's about all I got to say about that.
Join us, won't you?
Yes. And speaking of joining us, if you like what you hear, if you want to ask us a question, if you want to hear us talk about some other kind of topics, if you want us to shut the hell up, check the Phantasmo After Dark Facebook page. Leave a comment there, and you could also email us at...
phantasmopod@gmail.com.
So once again, join us, won't you?
Well, I'll tell you, something marvelous has happened since the last time we sat down to record, and that is two episodes, count them two, of Phantasmo After Dark have been released out into the world, and people actually listen to them.
Did you say two?
Two episodes.
You know, that's the exact amount of people that listen to it, too. No, there were a few more that listened, and great. You know, that's really cool. I'm glad people did, and I hope they enjoyed it. It seems that they did. We must not, you know, we must be doing something right.
Or the folks listening are extremely polite, one or the other. But in any event, big thanks to everyone out there who took the time to listen to either one or both of the podcasts. We really do appreciate it. And again,
yes, indeed,
we encourage you to join the conversation. You don't have to be a passive listener. You can join the party by emailing us at phantasmopod@gmail.com or leaving a comment on the aforementioned Facebook page. Even a comment such as, "You suck, quit now."
"You guys are hacks. Hang it up."
It is preferable to the deafening silence. So.
And also, too, after each podcast, I will be posting pictures of some of the things we reference in the conversation, whether it be behind the scenes or tangents or anything else like that. Some interesting stuff will be on there to look at. So if you just want to come by and take a look, please do.
If you haven't watched the clip from High School Confidential, you really need to see that. Everybody needs to see that.
I think I'll start posting the trailers, too, of the movies that we talk about on there. That'd be kind of cool.
Yeah. Now, High School Confidential, I should point out, when we recorded the content of Episode 2, which is not actually about High School Confidential, High School Confidential is simply mentioned in one of the many tangents that we will soon...
Rust tangent?
Exactly. The Rust tangent. That's a callback, folks. Check out Episode 2. Anyhow, yes, it's mentioned, and I talked about maybe cutting some great sound bites into the episode. Too lazy to put that much work into the editing. Got enough editing to do, thanks. So we posted that clip instead. The reason why I brought this up and went on another tangent already, we have not said word one about Phantom of the Paradise.
We'll get there.
And I've already taken us to a whole other place, is... In the time since we recorded that episode, High School Confidential has been released on Blu-ray.
Oh, well, that's important. That's important information.
I am thrilled. I do, in fact, own the Blu-ray, and I will be tying Rob to a chair and making him watch High School Confidential so that we can talk about it on a future episode.
I'm in. Just, you know, we'll set up a day. So, our topic for tonight, Phantom of the Paradise. Where were you when you first saw the film?
You know, you are going to have the whole story for where you were when you first saw the film. I honestly have no idea where I even first heard about it or saw it. But how about you?
Well, I don't remember the first time I actually saw it, but I have a lot of memories of it from being a kid, being younger. Seeing pictures in Famous Monsters magazine, of course. That's where almost all of this interest in the genre for me stems from. And just seeing especially that same picture over and over, him with the mask and the cape flowing, swinging through the theater. And then I know I must have seen clips or have seen the movie when I was younger, because I had images of some of the scenes that I remember, but I do not remember actually sitting down and watching it until I was, late teens, early 20s, and I found it on VHS somewhere. Same thing. I don't remember when I first saw it. It just seems like it's kind of always been around, and I had seen it at some point, and it stuck with me.
Yeah, there's a lot to talk about with this movie.
This could be a two-parter.
There's a lot going on. Yeah. Also, we love it a lot. I mean, let's just have out with it right there. There's no sense in holding back. It's a very special movie to both of us on a number of levels. But
it's a kind of thing. You either love the movie or you could care less. You know, most people I've talked to about it, it's not like, well, it's okay, I'll watch it. It's either they really love it or they're like, eh, it didn't do anything for me. But yeah, we and all our close friends really love the movie too. It's
and those other folks are heathens.
That's right.
Philistines.
Deserving of no one's love.
When you said deserving of no one's love, for some reason it conjured the image in my mind of Gargamel from the Smurfs. A frowning, lonely Gargamel. I don't know.
That's what people who don't like Phantom of the Paradise look like.
Sad, lonely Gargamel.
So if you haven't seen it, you need to go out and watch it. Don't be a Gargamel.
Oh, it's highly debatable whether or not that one's getting cut out. That could be an edit right there. You know what would be fun? If right before I say Gargamel, I cut everything from that point until mm-hmm. I say, I don't know if I'm going to edit that or not, and just leave it as the eternal mystery of what the hell
what you edited.
Or put in a beep to censor it.
Do that.
Beep Gargamel every time I say it, and then no one will ever know.
That'd be awesome.
This part's definitely getting
Gargamel.
Better. So, Phantom of the Paradise is, as you could probably guess from the title, a take on Phantom of the Opera, sort of mashed up with...
rock and roll!
With Dorian Gray, right?
Yeah.
And Faust.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, Faust is referenced directly several mm-hmm. times in the movie. It is also a satire of the music business.
Oh, big satire, and the music business did not like it, from what I understand.
Yeah, satire of the music business and of media and pop culture in general, but particularly the recording industry
at the time.
Yeah,
and you know, bringing that up too, I do a lot of things I've read that music industry at the time really didn't like the movie because of that, because it was really kind of spot on in a lot of places. And it didn't sit well with them, so the movie did not do good at the box office. Was that on purpose, or was it just because people didn't go see it?
So I think for the most part, it was just people didn't show up. But there was an attempt made by certain folks within the music industry to interfere with the film's release. It had to be edited. There's a 50-minute featurette on the new Blu-ray.
Oh,
I think
cool.
It actually was a French-made documentary, but since all of the participants, as far as cast and crew, were English speakers, all they had to do was take the subtitles off and put it out right on the new Blu-ray. Anyhow,
cool.
They get into all that.
Now, the plot of the film, as we were saying,
yeah,
is strongly Phantom of the Opera,
definitely.
But it does. He's writing in the movie. He's writing a musical about Faust, but the movie itself is about Phantom of the Opera. And here's something I realized: the character Philbin in the movie,
yeah,
Mary Philbin. From the Chaney, the original Silent.
Wow. You know, I never picked up on that.
Not long ago. It just hit me. I was like, oh, duh.
Yeah.
A little nod and a wink to the original Phantom story.
Wow.
Mary Philbin played Christine in the Chaney Silent.
Well
film.
Scouted, sir.
Done my good deed for the day.
Right. So, as you were saying,
mm-hmm.
our would-be or will-be Phantom in the film, Winslow Leach, mm-hmm. played by William Finley.
Yes, the great William Finley, Brian De Palma favorite.
He's a composer writing a cantata, which tells the story of Faust.
Which he only sings solo.
He becomes the Phantom, but ultimately becomes Faust, or to a certain extent shares that role with our villain, Swan.
Of course, they all sell their soul for rock and roll at some point, don't
right,
they?
Yeah.
Everybody that signs a contract, so.
And Swan, of course, who is also the Dorian Gray connection.
Instead of a picture in the attic, he has 2¼-inch tape, whatever they recorded on back then.
Right, of himself as a young man. So, one thing that I find interesting, which may, of course, be interesting to no one else but me, and that is this version of the Phantom is, like many takes on Phantom after the what was it, 42? When was the Claude Rains?
Oh, God. You
Technicolor
had to ask me
Phantom
that.
Made?
Yes, when the Claude Rains Technicolor Phantom was made, yes,
right.
That one.
That movie is actually what introduces the idea of the Phantom being a composer who has his music stolen.
Oh, yeah, that's
and
right.
And his face is disfigured, either as a result of the struggle with the thief or... or the thief actually disfigures him. I lose track of what happens in which version, and I don't watch that Claude Rains Phantom very often because it's horribly dull. But
you're right. When you're right, you're right. I mean,
I love Claude Rains, bless him, but that's not my favorite take on the film. So if I remember correctly, in the novel Phantom of the Opera, there is none of that business about him having been a composer, and he has his music stolen, and then there's some sort of struggle, and his face is disfigured as a result.
Yeah, no, I think the original, and I've never read the book. I'm just going from the Cheney, the silent film, right. But he was born that way, wasn't he?
Right, in the book he's born disfigured, that's right, and yeah. I believe the Cheney Phantom is exactly the same thing. Again, it's with that Claude Rains version that they introduce the composer angle, but that's also the same take that they use for the Hammer Phantom.
Uh-huh, yeah. And that's the origin that most people relate to, or know, rather. And
which one, the Claude Rains?
Yeah, the being disfigured as a result of an action, not being born that way.
Now, did you ever see the Lloyd Webber musical? I've heard the soundtrack, but I've never seen it.
Yeah, I saw it when it came into theater, and it goes to the book.
Right,
as
so
far
he's,
as I mean,
born
that way.
Disfigured,
yeah.
Okay. The other thing that puts me in mind of the Hammer, the Terrence Fisher Phantom of the Opera, starring Herbert Lom,
mm-hmm.
is just how nasty of a villain who isn't the Phantom we get in both Phantom of the Paradise and...
Oh, yeah.
Because Swan, he's just cruel for the sake of being cruel a lot of the time.
Short man complex.
Yeah, and if you go back to that Hammer Phantom, the Michael Goff character, just a nasty piece of work, man. Just again, just an awful person.
You know, I don't know.
Cruel for me.
I cannot remember the last time that I saw that version because I can't remember a damn thing about it. You know, I don't know if I've ever sat through that Hammer Phantom from start to finish.
It's flawed but interesting. The conventional wisdom on it is that it isn't very good. My take is that it's better than the conventional wisdom would have you believe.
Yeah,
but not great. It's got some you know critical flaws that kind of keep it out of the upper tier of Hammer picks,
The mask is awful that he hides his face with, so I'm just going there. Because in Phantom of the Paradise, the helmet is awesome.
That's true.
And that's, you know, I think that's one of the bigger draws, or at least gets people's attention, is the visual. You know, you see that character in that helmet. I know that's what probably drew me to it. And most of the things, I'm really visually oriented than a lot of the things that I like. And I'm guessing that's probably what drew me to it, at least sparked my interest to find out more about it. That G-Force Battle of the Planets bird-like helmet there. And it's just a great look with that sleek black costume and the flowing cape and then that silver, almost beak-like helmet.
And his talk box.
Yeah. And it's a striking image, you know. And there's a lot of imagery in the film, from the juicy fruits and the undeads and then Beef and everybody. Swan and his different looks and outfits throughout the movie. I love his isn't that his opening scene? He comes in that robe with the dragons embroidered all over it. That is the first time you
see
his face.
That's the first time you get a good look at him.
Yeah, that's the first time
he's
kind of
kept like you see his gloved hands and little hints of him. I don't think you really see him.
No, you don't.
Until like 20, 25 minutes into the
Yeah,
into the
and that's the first shot of his face you see, is that scene.
That's right.
Yeah, where is that coat now, I want to know. I don't think Paul Williams kept it.
I don't know.
These are things I think about. Yeah.
So two things that we're holding back on here is to talk about the filmmaker and the star, or at least primary co-star. And I think the reason why we've been holding back on that is because either of those subjects can
lead
us
many
off
different tangents.
Long tangents, and probably will. I mean, we're not going to talk about the filmmaker, Brian De Palma, or the star, Paul Williams, without talking about
A lot of other things. Talk about the rest of the cast real quick then. How about that? The Undeads, the Juicy Fruits, the Beach Bums, those three guys. Archie Hahn, Jeffrey Comanor, I think that's how you pronounce his last name, and Harold Oblong. That was his pseudonym in that. Now, it'll come to me in a little bit. I'll keep talking while you look it up. How about that?
Don't give away our secrets, Rob. Nobody knows. Okay.
While
nobody
you,
knows
while
about
you sit
the,
over there and rub your chin and think, hmm.
Nobody knows about the internet. It's our little secret.
I actually saw
away.
Peter Ebeling. That's his name.
Why did I think it was Nigel? Is that
Peter Ebeling?
Is that the character's
name? I saw him on an episode of NCIS the other night. Believe it or not, the cat is still working. He got blowed up right at the very beginning, but he's still working. He was driving in a car and has like a good minute or two scene with a lot of dialogue. Another thing he was on in the 70s was he was on the episode of WKRP where they had, he was in the, oh, what was the band? He was part of the band, this English band. They were notorious and it'll come to me later. I was three guys. He was one of them. And they wore business suits, but they were supposed to be this horrible band that tore up everything. But Peter Ebeling, Harold Oblong, has done a lot of stuff over the years. And that was one of them. And he showed up in a lot of other, you know, one-offs on TV through the 70s and 80s. Jeffrey Commander, I think he, after Phantom, I don't know if he did much else, but I know he went on to be like a doctor and got out of show business for the longest time. The only time that I know that he came back was when they did the Phantom Palooza convention a few years ago in Canada, and he reunited with the Undeads and they performed. Archie Hahn, though, has done tons of stuff. I mean, he was in, has a small part in My Favorite Year, very visible at the end of that movie. That's something I remember. But he's done lots of stuff over the years, and you were telling me something I didn't know earlier about him.
Right. Well, quite by coincidence, I was listening to the newest, as of this recording, episode of the Nerdist podcast, and their guest was Paul Reubens.
Hmm. Makes sense.
Paul okay. Reubens was a groundling.
Yes.
And he knew Archie Hahn. Archie Hahn was with that crowd in those days in the 70s. And he said...
Tons of people came through there.
That Archie Hahn was chosen to be one of the original Ready for Primetime players.
Not Ready for Primetime players.
Pardon me, Not Ready for Primetime players on Saturday Night Live. And turned it down because he was in the middle of building what would become the Groundling Theater. And he was determined to finish the job. So
what could have been.
I know. And it's amazing because, you know, he's not a household name, but many people are because he...
Because of what he did.
Built
yeah.
that theater.
I mean, God, everybody. I mean, what, Mike Myers, I think, came through there.
Clearly Paul Reubens.
Paul Reubens, Cassandra Peterson, Elvira
yeah.
came through there.
Phil Hartman, famously.
Yeah. Mindy Sterling, who was in the, what was her character's name, the Frau in the Austin Powers movies.
Yeah, there's a lot.
It's her most famous role, but she's been in tons of stuff. But tons of people were groundlings yeah,
a lot
at one point
of SNL
or another.
Alumni particularly came from there.
Yeah, so he did important work.
He did.
And
here's to you, Archie Hahn.
Yeah, here's to you right here. Little clinkies there. The rest of the cast, before we get to the biggies there, Philbin. Arnold Philbin.
Yeah.
George Mamoli, who was part of another comedy troupe in the 60s, Ace Trucking Company, which had Fred Willard and blonde, glasses, mustache.
Oh, Fernwood Tonight?
Fernwood Tonight with Fred Willard.
Yeah, yeah.
I think he was in Ace Trucking Company. I'm not sure. Maybe Murray Langston was in it also. Some other guys that you would recognize that were in that. But, oh, God, why can't...
Martin Mull.
Great, great comedian. Funny guy, you know. But, yeah, I think he was in Ace Trucking Company. I could be wrong, but I know Fred Willard was. And they appeared on the Tom Jones Show. They were regulars on there. But that's where George Mamoli comes from. And I think he passed away some years ago. But the name Philbin... being a tribute to Mary Philbin, that's kind of cool.
It's a great part, too.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He gets a lot of great dialogue.
He does.
He sort of disappears in the second half of the movie. Well, he's still in it, but he's not in it as prominently.
Yeah, he doesn't have much to do.
But in the beginning, he's got just some great some great dialogue, like that exchange between...
that first exchange between him and Swan, right?
Oh,
at the beginning.
Yeah, which is essentially a monologue. You don't see Swan. He's looking at the camera effectively, yeah. and he's talking about...
It's basically a monologue of backstory for the viewer.
Right, right.
Which is fantastic.
It
though,
really
the way
is.
It's done.
She was more than just a piece to me.
She was the love of my life. I told her who to beep, who to be nice to. That's great.
And then he gets that little exchange with William Finley later with, Mike Cantata tells the story of Faust. Who? Faust. What label's he on?
Yeah, what label's he on? Just give me two or three of the catchy numbers. And of course, he's got the two great exchanges with Beef, one in the dressing room and one in the alley
yeah.
later on, which I'm not going to spoil that for you. You got to see the movie. Which brings us to Beef.
Garrett Graham,
the great Garrett Graham, who has been in tons of stuff. National Lampoon's Class Reunion, Used Cars, geez, just name it. He's been in, always kind of one of those guys that's on the back burner of stuff. A lot of TV in the 70s.
National Lampoon's Class Reunion, is that the one that's basically like a prom night style slasher?
Yeah, yeah.
Comedy?
They have a class reunion and they do it. At the rundown school that they used to go to, and Garrett Graham, I think he's one of the snobby guys that comes back, you yeah. know, Biff, Muffy, that kind of thing. I believe that's his character, and I tell you, it's a funny damn movie. I've got it on VHS. I haven't seen it show up on DVD. Of course, I haven't been looking either.
Am I right about that prom night thing, or am I just mixing up two school-based movies from around the same time?
Well, they come back. What it is, the story of that is, and here comes a tangent that I'll try to wrap up quickly. When they were in school, graduating night, they made fun of this one guy, this nerdy guy. They were going to set him up with a girl, and they say she's embarrassed, so she has a bag over his head. Well, he starts making out with a girl, and I think he has sex with her, and he pulls a bag off her head, and it's like his sister, who's really just him in drag when they cut the camera. And of course he goes crazy and they're all laughing at him. Then it switches, 10 years later or 15 years later, they have their class reunion and he's there killing them off one by one,
right
at the classroom. So it is kind of the prom night thing.
Yeah, it kind of is.
It's funny. I mean, early National Lampoon film stuff, so check it out, won't you? But Garrett Graham, yeah, fantastic job doing Beef, the glitter rock star of questionable sexuality and who cannot walk in platform shoes, but has some great outfits throughout the film.
Right.
And he knows drug reel from real.
So now that we've introduced Beef, we can maybe talk a little bit about what you were alluding to earlier.
Jessica Harper.
Or we'll come back. We'll come back to that and talk about Jessica Harper.
Now, Jessica Harper is important because, well, she's one of the stars of the film, but
yeah,
the lead female character, but she also has a connection to another cult film by way of its sort of sequel. I believe this was her first film.
I believe you are correct.
If I'm not mistaken.
I believe they found her on stage looking for a singer. Really,
yeah, incredible voice. And she still has those pipes, too. I've heard her sing not long ago, and she still sings just as good. But she, this being her first role, and then she went on to do some other things, did Suspiria. But the connection I'm talking about, she was in Shock Treatment playing Janet Weiss, or Janet Majors at this point. It was the sort of sequel to the Rocky Horror Picture Show. And she and Clifty Young play Brad and Janet. And it's another one that is a cult film, and it's catchy music, and she is... sounds great in it. A lot of people who like Rocky Horror do not like it or did not like it, but it is a movie that kind of grows on you. The songs more than the film itself, but that's kind of where she went. And after that, I'm not sure what she did much of. I know she ended up on, Gary Shandling had a show on Showtime for a while called It's Gary Shandling Show. And the last season, I think, of that, she played his girlfriend, and they did a spoof of Phantom of the Paradise on it with Mark Blankfield from Fridays playing the Phantom character.
Wow.
Yeah, it was. I'd love to find a copy of that just to have it. Oh, it was incredible.
When you said Mark and paused, you know what I was hoping you were going to say? Mark Skippy Price. Mark Skippy Price. Now, look, I'd like to request that the audience please send us emails or Facebook messages encouraging Rob to join me in covering the Mark Skippy Price classic, Trick or Treats.
You know, we're going to have to do that eventually. We'll do a rock and roll movie series, which this is part of. So, you know, and we'll have to cover
the vision is coming together. The vision of rock. Yes.
Oh, God.
Oh, Mark Skippy.
I saw that in the theater, by the way, when it came out. Yes, I did. But anyway,
I did not see it in the theater. I did see it on video when it was released on video. And hey, look, I'll tell you right now, I loved it. And I haven't seen it since.
Oh, I have. Let me tell you, brother, it does not hold up.
Well, when I was 15, I was that kid, okay? So I love that movie.
hey, I was right there, man. I was right there. I mean, I went to see it because Gene Simmons was in it, you know?
Yeah.
And it was about rock and roll and, yeah, and, you know. And
Rock's Chosen Warriors will rule the apocalypse.
That's right. That's right. And Sammy Kerr, played by, you know, one of the guys that was in the movie Chorus Line.
So
and who was Jessica a solid gold dancer.
Jessica Harper.
Yes.
As far as we know, has absolutely no relationship to Mark Skippy Price.
I think we've proved otherwise.
I'm certain she's been active on stage all these many years, assuming that she wants to be anyway.
She's on Facebook.
Because
I have
she has a marvelous, marvelous singing voice, and that's where she got her start. So I'm sure that she's continued that if she damn well pleases. However, what a cult film pedigree.
Oh, yeah.
Right? We've got, of course, Phantom of the Paradise, as you said, Shock Treatment, and then as you so quickly glossed over, sir, she plays Susie Banyan, the lead character in Suspiria, one of the most iconic horror films the 70s.
I glossed over that on purpose because I was leaving that to you. That's your arena right there more than mine.
That's my arena.
Take it away, Commodore!
God knows we probably spend enough time on this as it is. However, we'll just leave that, shall we? Suffice it to say, I'm a great admirer of the Italian horror films of the 60s and 70s. So.
No.
A little bit.
Look for a future podcast on Italian horror films.
Please join us, won't you?
That's our tagline right there. But anyway, that covers the cast, I do believe. Did we leave anybody out? I think that's it until we get now to
until
the...
Until we get to
Bill Finley.
Oh, yeah.
Duh, the Phantom himself. Brian De Palma, favorite. He was in Sisters.
Right.
With Margot Kidder.
Sisters, which was made just before this, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Before Phantom.
And even recently, before he passed away, just a couple years ago, he was in The Black Dahlia. Had a small part in that. So De Palma kept him working. He was in The Funhouse, which I watched not too long ago. I love that movie. Have to watch it every Halloween, if not more often. And he was in Silent Rage, a Chuck Norris film with Ron Silva.
Right.
Believe it or not. And Stephen Furst. So, now how's that for a cast?
Oh boy, isn't this great?
Here's a tangent. Okay, here's the cast. I'm proposing a movie and here's the cast. Ron Silva, William Finley, Stephen Furst, and Chuck Norris.
Sounds like box office to me.
That's right. And it actually is a creepy damn film.
Yeah.
It's more of a suspense horror film than it is a typical Chuck Norris film.
Right.
Check that one out. We should talk about that at some point too, maybe. But anyway, back to Bill Finley. That's about all I can think of that he was in other than Phantom. I'm sure there was other stuff. And rest in peace. He passed away not too long ago. And that brings us to Paul Williams. And Brian De Palma.
That's right.
Which should we start with? How about Paul Williams?
Let's.
The movie would not be the movie it is without the music of Paul Williams. In the 70s, he was one of the top-selling songwriters. Wrote for everybody. The Carpenters had quite a few hits of his songs. What was it? Was it The Poseidon Adventure? One of those boat turned upside down movies, The Morning After, was the theme, and that was a hit on the radio at the time. And he wrote that. And
we wrote Rainy Days and Mondays and Old Fashioned Love Song.
Oh, Three Dog Night, yeah. Plus what hits he had of it himself singing.
Yeah, so he performed some of his own songs and had hits with those, and wrote hit songs for plenty of other people, as we've said. And let's just cut to the chase, shall we? He wrote the song for the Muppet movie. Okay.
Oh yeah, the original Muppet movie. He wrote the entire soundtrack.
The man wrote Rainbow Connection. And okay, look, everybody says, "Oh, Rainbow Connection. Rainbow Connection is the best song ever." No, sir. No. Can you picture that? As performed by Dr. Teeth and the Electric Mayhem.
Do you know?
That's the standout track from Muppet Movie as far as this man is concerned.
And you can edit this out, okay, if you like, or you can leave it in. But when I was hosting the Tarantino burlesque show at the Narrow last year, or earlier this year, we were supposed to play the Sons of Frankenstein, my band. We were supposed to play, and we decided, well, you know, we not that familiar with music from Tarantino films, but we'll just do a short set of just songs from movies. And we started... I started learning, Can You Picture That? We were going to do that. And something happened, one thing or another. I think the drummer just couldn't get the time off, so we scrapped playing there at all. Oh, that's what it was. We couldn't get together to rehearse. That's what it was. But that, eventually we will learn that and play that live, and it's going to be a surprise. Not anymore, apparently.
And for the sake of the audience, I will point out that, yes, in fact, I did encourage Rob and his band to play Little Green Bag, but... they weren't having any of it. Tarantino theme be damned.
But anyway, back to Paul Williams and the Muppets. He also wrote the soundtrack to The Muppet Christmas Carol. Got back with the Henson Associates later and did that. And there's some great Christmas songs on there, but the songs from the Muppet movie, just they stay with you. Everybody knows Rainbow Connection and Moving Right Along and Can You Picture That?
Right. And so he was also an actor, obviously, and this is one of his earlier roles, I think. I'm not sure how active he had been in television before he did Battle for the Planet of the Apes and Phantom of the Paradise.
He did a movie, I cannot think of it off the top of my head, maybe it'll come to you out of the blue here in a second. Phyllis and I got it off Netflix. I can't remember what it was or why we got it now, but all of a sudden, it looked like a 12-year-old, he was probably in his 20s, Paul Williams shows up. We're like, holy crap! It was black and white, and he has really short hair, and I can't remember what it was. But yeah, he was all over TV guest spots in the 70s. Battle for the Planet of the Apes says, and introducing Paul Williams. So, but that wasn't his first movie role.
Right. Well, the Magic Box says that he had three film roles before Battle of the Battle for the Planet of the Apes.
Uh-huh.
The Loved One, The Chase, and Watermelon Man.
He was in Watermelon Man with Jeffrey Cambridge?
Apparently so.
That's a funny damn movie.
Yeah.
What were the first two?
The Loved One and The Chase.
The Loved One and The Chase. It's got to be one of those. I can't remember. But anyway, he doesn't have a very big part in it. It's a small part. But Battle for the Planet of the Apes, he has a healthy part in that.
Right.
And there's some great footage of him. If you go on YouTube, I'll try to post some of this later, where he comes out on The Tonight Show in his Virgil makeup, his apes makeup.
Yeah, I've seen that.
And sings just a song, like one of his new songs. And it was so bizarre. And so he must have been, you know, just stoned out of his mind and thought, this is a good idea. But it's cool, though.
We should point out that Mr. Williams is in recovery now and has been for decades.
I think he has been. I saw a documentary. There's a documentary on, I want to say, on Netflix. And I forget what it's called, but it's about Paul Williams, this guy did recently. And he has been clean and sober for quite a few years now. But they do talk about in the 70s and 80s how he had drug and alcohol problems. And he really doesn't like that part of himself from back then. And the documentary is not really that. It's not a happy documentary, but it is a little insightful.
Yeah.
As what he's been doing the last few years and how big he still is in other countries.
Right.
As far as touring and playing concerts and such. And hey, he's one of my favorite all-time songwriters. The man can write a song. And I've got quite a few albums of his. There's one he did where I forget what it's called now, but I do have it, where it's he sings all the hits that he wrote for other people.
Yeah. I think I've heard
that. And he sings old souls.
Right.
Which I don't know if you've ever heard him do it, but it's pretty cool. And some of the Carpenter songs and all. I'll have to dig that out and try to see if I can transfer that to a disc for all my friends and loved ones. But anyway, that's my Paul Williams tangent. You got one?
But just as a presence, as a personality, he was sort of ubiquitous when I was little in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
As we said, he did a couple of, you know, big features. Well, he did one. He did some features.
Yeah.
And
Fantasy Island.
Right. And then
and
he
Love
was
Boat
all over television through the 70s and 80s, you know, Hollywood Squares and Love Boat and Fantasy Island.
I'm sure he did a Charlie's Angels. And,
sure. It's just, you know, guest appearances all over the place. And it's interesting. There's just certain figures from that time who, if you were around, you know them, and they sort of give you a warm glow. It's sort of the difference between 70s celebrity culture is a variety show culture and a game show culture.
Oh, yeah.
Versus contemporary celebrity culture, which is a reality show.
Yeah. Well, you know, here's a whole other tangent, and you can edit this out as you please, okay? Because this may go on for a while and has nothing to do with Phantom of the Paradise. But, like you said, 70s celebrity culture, the time was three channels, two maybe UHF channels, but three network channels to choose from. And if you were, you know, an only child or even just a family and just watched a lot of TV, you saw a lot of these same faces over and over and over again. And like you said, you know, some of these people, their presence, just, you know, you get a warm feeling when you see them because they were in your living room all the time. Almost like, you know, like a friend you would see over and over again. And Paul Williams was one of those guys. I remember seeing him since I was a little kid, and I couldn't tell you in what, you know, what was the first time or what have you, but he was just in everything. Roddy McDowell is another one of those guys who showed up all over the place, and no matter what he did, you'd watch it. You know, no matter what Paul Williams was in, oh, it's Paul Williams. I got to watch it.
No, I agree with that. That's basically what I was getting at. Variety show versus reality show example was a guy like Paul Williams. You'd see him on television and whatever he was doing in those days, and say, "Hey, it's your buddy Paul Williams." Essentially, is how you would feel about that.
Yeah.
Oh, that Paul Lynde, or ooh, Vincent Price. You know,
yeah.
Spooky but fun, right? Plus Charles Nelson Reilly.
Oh, and everybody out there listening just did that at the same time,
right?
Oh.
Versus today, where it's what's that damn
flavor of the week?
What's that damn Kim Kardashian doing now? Let me watch everything she does so I can talk about how awful she is and how much I hate her or whatever. You know, it's just really bizarre.
Yeah, everybody's getting their 15 minutes, and nobody has any real personality to them.
Yeah.
You know, there's nobody with any, in reality, stars, there's no talent. You know, there's nothing that makes you want to watch them in anything they're in.
While I agree with that, I mean, at the same time, there's definitely a subjective element to that where, you know, you could easily be dismissed as, well, you like what's most familiar to you and dislike what's new. But I think what isn't as subjective is just what you can observe about the audience's relationship to its pop culture icons of today versus the audience's relationship to its pop culture icons of those days.
Oh, yeah.
Also, you know, we should point out that, you know, we were kids at the time. So I'm not sure how adults, or say our parents, would have processed some of these same personalities.
Well, that's an interesting point. It'd be, yeah.
But, you know, we could belabor that all day long. The point is, you get a warm glow. I get a warm glow from the Paul Williams people, okay? That's what I'm saying. Whether it's one of his great songs or just, you know, him hanging out being smarmy on the Hollywood squares or whatever it is, you know.
He's comfortable. Like an old shoe.
But with all that said, he's wonderful as Swan. It's a great performance.
Oh, yeah. He plays the smarmy, creepy. He makes it happen. And there's Paul Williams. How about Brian De Palma now, the director of the film?
Everything that we've talked about so far with the cast.
Mm-hmm.
Now how much would you pay?
Just the cast alone, you've got a full plate. A full plate. You got a movie right there with just the cast.
But with all that said, even having established that you get full value just from these great performers doing fun stuff.
Only one man could have made this film.
Right. I mean, he as with just about everything he does, really, he is ultimately the star of the picture. If you love the craft of filmmaking, if you revel in technique employed artfully by someone who's extremely good at it, then you are or ought to be a Brian De Palma fan.
Oh, God, yes.
Doesn't make every one of his films a success, doesn't make it, you know, artistically or commercially. he's done some things that I will be the first to criticize.
But they always have his stamp on them.
Right.
And you can tell it's a Brian De Palma film. Even if you don't know the film, you watch about 5 or 10 minutes and you go, this looks like a Brian De Palma film.
Right.
Which is a good thing.
It's a very visual, very cinematic picture. You know, it's a Brian De Palma film, but, you know, that's what it is. And, you know, he employs a lot of the techniques that he's known for incorporating silent film techniques, or I should say techniques most associated with silent films, using split screen, using split diopter.
That's a big one, yeah.
And a lot of tracking, moving cameras snake through and wind around
the scene itself.
Yeah, exactly. And to get that kind of cinema, to make that happen, takes an awful lot of control and poise and forethought on the part of the filmmaker. For me. And, you know, there's going to be folks out there who know this movie and are going to respond to what I'm saying by saying that I'm overselling it. And I get that to a certain extent, but this is genuinely how I feel about it. To me, the particular, peculiar genius of Phantom of the Paradise as a piece of filmmaking is that visual approach that I just described absolutely takes firm control to accomplish, and yet the whole film has a feeling of play, a feeling of improvisation, a feeling of creative people just having a good time with the material.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely.
You know, so to be able to maintain that control and achieve that visual presentation, that cinema that he achieves, and still maintain that sense of play and improvisation and letting the performers do their thing and have their space. It's remarkable.
Yeah, what he said. That goes double for me. No, but you're right. I mean, in all seriousness. And I was going to actually say the film itself is a star of the film because of the way it's made.
Yeah.
With, like you say, his split screen, which is like his trademark. Yeah, and the way the camera moves around. You don't really see that kind of filmmaking anymore.
You really don't.
And it's shame. It's sad.
Well, with De Palma, you're dealing with somebody who knows his cinema history, who knows his cinema technique, both technically and in its historical context. And you're dealing with somebody with the talent to employ that knowledge in a creative way. You know, he wrote the script, and I'm sure that the Mary Philbin reference was not...
that was right. Dead on purpose.
And, you know, he's known probably, I guess primarily he's known outside of his big commercial studio stuff, some of which is not very successful. We won't talk about Mission to Mars, but and Bonfire of the Vanities and things like that. Yeah. I guess he's probably known primarily for the thrillers.
Yeah.
Right.
But, you know, you're talking about, you got a class of directors, I guess, or era of directors that grew up loving film and the craft of film. Whereas today we've got a lot of directors, not all, but a lot who grew up in the microwave generation, the music video generation, the, you know, get all your information in 3 minutes. That's the kind of a lot of the kind of movies we're getting these days. There's some gems out there, but overall, you don't see the work like De Palma did.
Well, here we go, folks. Okay, so this is related to what I was going to get into with the thrillers. And I could go on and on about this, so I'll try to rein it in. You talked about film history and film technique and what you might call film grammar, you know, how you tell a story cinematically. In the 60s, in the Truffaut interviews, Hitchcock said that the technology changes, but the filmmaking technique hasn't really changed much since Griffith.
Oh,
so
okay, yeah.
Griffith basically came up with the beginnings of cinematic vocabulary, of film grammar.
Yeah.
And Hitchcock's point is that, you know, we make a lot of technological changes, but those fundamentals, that film grammar is pretty much the same as it was since Griffith. And if I'm not misquoting him, I think he says something in the effect of, you know, it will always be that way.
Yeah.
Now, today, the technology has changed far more.
Oh.
And in ways I'm sure Hitchcock could never have imagined when he was alive.
Yeah.
But I think it holds true that film grammar hasn't really changed since Griffith. I think what's true today is that intentionally employing what you might call bad grammar for effect has become acceptable.
Wow, that's zen.
So, you know, shaking the camera, canted angles for no damn reason, as if you don't know what a canted angle is supposed to do, you know, drift frames, all these things that are very popular, all these techniques that are very popular, you know, obscuring the action instead of framing the action. The rules have not changed, but now breaking the rule has become
the norm,
right?
Yeah.
To a certain extent.
And
so
that makes everything look the same.
Right.
You can't tell one director from another when you look at a film.
Right.
You know, I mean, you could tell in the day, you could tell a De Palma film from a Peckinpah film. You know, okay, let's go to Hammer, okay? You can tell a Terrence Fisher from a Freddie Francis film.
Without a doubt, yeah.
But today...
I'd like to think I'm open to finding it today, that I'm not so biased that I'm blind, but then I don't see everything that comes out today.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't either. There's not much that really interests me.
Yeah.
You know, but back to De Palma and Phantom of the Paradise.
Well, yeah, well, I told you this was going to go on.
That's
so
fine.
We'll just keep on going and see.
Yeah.
Because you mentioned Tarantino as well, and that brings up an interesting point to me. So De Palma, as we talked about, he knows his film history and he knows his technique.
Mm-hmm.
And he will employ both of those things over and over again in, you know, creative and interesting ways in the films that he makes. He will even go so far as to quote or restage whole sequences from other films. Most famously, there's a gunfight in The Untouchables that's basically a restage of the Odessa Steppe sequence from the Battleship Potemkin.
Oh, yeah.
And De Palma was highly criticized for this in a lot of places. Of course, his thrillers, so we're talking about Obsession and Dress to Kill.
Yeah.
And Blowout.
Uh-huh.
And I'm missing one, Body Double.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And A Raising Cain, and then later Snake Eyes, which I did not like, but Femme Fatale, which I loved. We'll talk about that another time. He is often criticized for aping Hitchcock, is what they say, which is just about the most uninsightful, small-minded way to read those movies. Now, in response to that criticism, De Palma has said that he's painting with the master's tools. He's not stealing. Yeah. But even then, he's sort of understating what he manages to accomplish in these things, because, you know, he's taking the themes and some of the techniques from some very famous films, and he's applying them in order to create something new.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at Body Double, just for one example, which I really like Body Double. It's not even one of the strongest ones, but yeah. It's good.
Yeah.
What's remarkable about it to me is a lot of folks criticized it for being a ripoff, quote unquote, of Vertigo and Rear Window, or Rear Window.
Yeah,
and Vertigo.
Yeah, I can see how they'd say that. Yeah.
And what the folks who dismiss it as such are missing is that it's not just aping Vertigo and Rear Window. It is dealing with the themes of Rear Window and Vertigo in the age of video.
Yeah.
The idea in the presence of videotape just permeates the entire, it runs through the entire movie, right?
Oh, yeah.
Surveillance video, home movies shot on video, mm-hmm. music video, video porn. This is a constant thread that goes through the movie. And so what the movie is doing is it's saying, you know, what do these ideas of voyeurism and the things that go on in Rear Window and Vertigo, how do those look in this day and age where, you know, anyone mm-hmm. can get one of these video camcorders?
Oh, yeah.
It's such a, you follow what I'm saying?
Yeah, which is more relevant now, I think, than it was then.
Right, so he's taking that and he's making it something new and he's saying something new with it. I mean, Blowout is the same way. It all has significance. And it's ridiculous to assert that all you have to do to make a high quality thriller is watch some Hitchcock and ape what you see. You know what I mean? As if Hitchcock films are some kind of paint by numbers deal that anybody who tries hard enough can study it and just make one. You know, it's a ridiculous assertion.
Now, not to mean to interrupt you there, but you said aping, and I use that term a lot myself.
Yeah.
Where's the line between aping and paying tribute to? Because De Palma, of course, a Hitchcock fan, and like you said, you know, he's using the master's tools, but painting a different picture.
Right.
Do you think some of the things he did were like nods and winks, like just paying a little tribute to the master there?
Well, that's a good question. I think what he's doing is going beyond the nod and the wink. Mm-hmm. I think it is a serious study of those themes in a different context, and I think that's what differentiates him from a Tarantino ultimately.
Yeah.
I started this rant by saying you mentioned Tarantino and then never got back to Tarantino, but it relates because Tarantino, I mean, everybody has their critics, everybody's got something to say,
mm-hmm.
but I would hazard that Tarantino in his day has been more consistently celebrated than De Palma was when he was most active. I think Tarantino has probably taken less flack than De Palma mm-hmm. has when effectively, you know, Tarantino,
I'll tell you why too. Keep going.
Tarantino is to a certain extent doing the same thing, but he's not doing as much with it. I mean, Tarantino is also known for, you know, being a great cinephile and having mm-hmm. this brain full of cinematic images that he uses and employs in his own work and for quoting other movies.
Yeah.
But this is me, and others can make a case otherwise.
Yeah.
But for me, I often feel like, as much as I enjoy most of Tarantino's movies, and I truly do, when I'm watching him quote things, I'm just going, yeah, I know where that came from.
Yeah.
I'm not going, oh, look what new thing he did with that.
Yeah.
I'm just going, yes, Quentin, I've seen those Italian gangster movies too, or whatever.
Yeah.
You know? And,
Well, I think Tarantino makes his version of movies that he liked.
Yeah.
Or he makes, you know, movies that he wants to see.
Yeah.
And he makes fun films. Does he make high art? I don't think so. But he makes movies that are fun popcorn movies to watch. And his are definitely nods and winks to other things. Because right. you look at it and you go, I know where that came from.
Right.
Oh, I know where that came from. And I think he's doing that on, he does it on purpose to go like, hey, see what I did there?
Right.
And that's not a bad thing because he is doing it on purpose. He's not trying to disguise it as something else.
Right.
You know,
yeah, exactly. And so that's where I was going is the nod and the wink thing. I think Tarantino's pictures are full of nods and full of winks that don't necessarily have a lot of substance and don't really, which isn't to say the movies themselves don't have substance
mm-hmm.
and isn't to say they don't have value and they don't accomplish things because they do.
Yeah.
But the nods and the winks in and of themselves are to me sometimes empty and they don't have much new to say. Whereas in a lot of times, I mean, okay. So was the Odessa Steps sequence in Untouchables more than a nod and a wink? No, probably not.
Yeah.
Probably not. I can't really make a case for that. But
that's
I would
okay
say
once in a while.
But by and large, again, particularly the thrillers, which I think are the works of his that will survive, that, mm-hmm. that he'll be known for.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And they're also amongst the works of his that have taken the most criticism outside of the flops like Mission to Mars and whatnot. I think there's a lot of substance in them. Every one of them.
And real quick, while you were talking about, you say Tarantino has been more successful or lauded more for his films than De Palma ever did or had more critics, whatever. Well, the reason is because the internet and communication, as far as everybody and their brother can get their opinion out there. Whereas when De Palma was around the 70s, you had the only thing everybody heard was critics, reviews, and papers. You know, the average guy, or word of mouth.
Yeah.
But now you can, you know, flip open your laptop, cut on your computer, and you've got hundreds of thousands different opinions from people all over the world on the same topic that you're talking about right now. Whereas before, you had a handful to pull from. And so if De Palma was making movies today, you know, who knows? Who knows what the reviews would be like? But then again, also, too, you've got the different culture, like we were talking about, different pop culture, when Tarantino is doing a nod and a wink to a bygone era, and people are big for anything nostalgia these days.
Yeah.
So he's got a niche, and when he sticks to that, he pretty much rolls out of success every time.
Yeah, and I think that the substance of his movies is ultimately in the writing. I think in the cinema itself, it's often, you know, full of quotes and winks and mm-hmm. nods now, but you know, the flip side of that is it's pretty well done.
Yeah,
and they are fun.
I love Tarantino movies.
Well, I'm talking about the camera work. It's mm-hmm. like it's not like he doesn't have a strong sense of the frame and how to use the camera, because he absolutely does. He studied it enough.
That's right.
So he's actually an exception to what we were talking about before, where you're saying it's harder to find mm-hmm. That Michael sort of Bay. Thing in movies nowadays, but. Anyway,
back to Brian De Palma and Phantom of the Paradise, which is what this podcast is about.
Phantom of the Paradise is good. Y'all should watch it because it's good.
Next topic.
Yep, next.
now let's go back. Let's talk more about quirky things about the movie. How about that? About the Phantom of the Paradise. I have not yet seen the extras on the DVD, mm-hmm. or the Blu-ray, rather. So I don't know all the stuff about the interviews and a lot of the behind-the-scenes stuff. Some stuff that I've knew over the years, such as Sissy Spacek, the Oscar-winning actress, was, before she got into films, was the set dresser on this picture. And her name is in the credits. Mm-hmm. And she almost burned down the set one day, which is one of her big, I guess, claims of fame before getting Carrie or before acting in general. And Sissy Spacek, who does live somewhere in Virginia with her husband, by the way.
I had no idea.
Yeah. Now, you have seen the behind-the-scenes stuff, the mm-hmm. extras on the Blu-ray. Any other quirky anecdotes you can share with the class?
Well, I don't know if you can call it quirky, but we can wrap back around to what you were saying at the beginning of the podcast.
How many days ago?
Yeah. Some of the interference with the film. They do talk about that quite a bit in the extras. So, Swan, Paul Williams' character.
Yes.
Who is a music mogul
mm-hmm.
In the film, has a record label of his own.
Called?
Well, the record label is called Death Records, but the company that Death Records is a part of.
Subsidiary.
Swan Song,
which, hey kids, if you grew up in the 70s or you're a fan of classic rock, Led Zeppelin's label, their own label, much like the Beatles' Apple label, was Swan Song. And they were very big when this movie came out.
And they had just established the Swan Song label, I believe, sort of while the movie was being made. Those two things kind of happened in parallel. So using the name Swan Song in the script for Phantom of the Paradise was not a deliberate reference or anything like that to the Zeppelin label. But two things happened. The Zeppelin camp, their management, objected to the use of the name Swan Song.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I believe their manager or somebody involved at a high level with the Swan Song organization, I don't remember which, had a personal vendetta, basically, because he saw an early screening of the film.
It was probably their manager. All reports, he was kind of a bear of a guy.
Yeah. Are we avoiding? You said something about spoilers earlier. Are we avoiding spoilers?
No. Go for it.
So the part in the movie where Beef is killed, he's electrocuted on mm-hmm. stage, is based on a real story of a musician being electrocuted on stage.
Oh.
They don't name him in the featurette, and I don't know who he is. But there's a musician who was electrocuted on stage. This musician was a friend of the manager.
Oh.
In question. Right. So when he saw that scene, he was very personally offended. And he vowed, even if he had to spend every penny of his own money, to keep the film from being, right?
Wow.
I don't remember if it was keep the film from being seen or to have that scene cut out, or yeah. I don't remember which one. They do talk about this in the documentary. So ultimately, he was not able to prevent the film from being seen. But they did have their way with the Swan Song logo.
Which appears in the film quite a bit, and you can see it. Have they tried to badly cover it up with primitive animation editing techniques at the time?
Yeah.
The two that stick out in my mind, I think, is the one where Winslow is either entering or leaving the record factory, and above the door,
mm-hmm.
I think they have blacked out. Yeah. And you can see it because it kind of wiggles and moves.
Yeah.
And then when Swan is addressing the reporters and introducing Beef at the airport, the podium, I guess, originally said Swan Song on it, but they have not digitally, but actually, I guess, hand done, mm-hmm. or however it was to edit the film back then, put a Death Records white label with the black.
And that does wiggle when you're looking at it.
It does move, yeah. It's really weird because when you're watching it the first time and you don't know that, you're like, what the hell? Why is that? You know, why did they do that?
Well, there's actually several other things that got cut or altered in some way because of that logo that uh-huh. you don't know about because they're not as obvious as
Now, some of them sneak by, though. Some of them they didn't cut. Like, some of the cameras get cut up.
Right.
I mean, it gets covered up, but some of them don't. You do see the word Swan Song a few times.
Well, there's a featurette on the... Now, I bought the UK release.
Oh, yeah, yeah. A nice tin.
So I don't know if the Scream Factory has the same featurette. The Scream Factory does, which is the recent US release, it does have some of the excised Swan Song footage.
Oh, wow.
Now, whether or not it has it in wrapped up in a featurette like the UK one, I don't know. But the UK one has a featurette with a voiceover that sort of shows the before and shows the after and actually explains to you
step
by step what was altered in each scene, and then, like I said, shows the before and the after. So
I can't wait to see that.
Yeah, it's pretty cool, and it's pretty cool if you're obsessive like me. Anyway,
raising my hand on this end of the table here.
Yeah. So there's that. Oh, one thing that the featurette finally answered for me that I was very happy about. As a matter of fact, I watched the movie again in preparation for the podcast, and then immediately watched the feature right after. So, you know, there's the scene in the movie where Winslow, having already given his music to Philbin, hasn't heard anything back from Swan's camp about the use of his music.
Oh, yeah, I'm waiting to hear about this.
So
yes.
He shows up at Swan Song, or at the Swanage. At the Swanage.
That's right.
To check in with Swan while he's rehearsing Girls for the cantata.
But I only sing it solo.
So there's this little fragment of a song that you hear in the movie as Winslow approaches the house. And it's the Never Thought That I Would Meet the Devil part, right?
Yeah.
Thought I'd meet him face and to face. As I've said many times and said again out loud while pointing at the screen during when my wife and I were watching it the other night, where is the rest of that song?
And me too, because it's not on the soundtrack. It's not on the album. It's not on the vinyl original release. It's not on DVD. CD re-releases. It is not there.
No. So Paul Williams actually addresses that in the featurette. I was so thrilled. It's not a complicated answer, but I was just, I mean, just minutes after however long it was after I had asked that question yet again aloud, Mr. Williams answered me. I was so happy. And it is that he was inspired to write that fragment just watching that scene in the moment.
Huh.
So he wrote the fragment with the idea that he would then go back and write the rest of the song and never did. And he says, I don't know why I never went back and wrote it.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, there was talk. I don't know if it ever materialized, but I want to say there was talk of a Phantom of the Paradise Broadway or off-Broadway show,
mm-hmm.
and Paul Williams was supposed to be writing new music for it. This was some years ago. I completely forgot about it until this very moment when you said that. I don't know if it ever materialized or ever went past that point of them in talks about it or not, but that would be something to check into because he was supposed to write new music for it.
Mm-hmm.
And that would have been one of the songs he finished, I bet. But it's a cool little tune, and it's not, what, it's like, what, 2-4 bars of music?
Yeah.
It's not long at all, but it's neat lyrics and just neat little bouncy little piano line.
I'm obviously a big fan of the soundtrack, and somebody I know happened to score me a very nice promo copy on vinyl.
You are welcome, Commodore.
Thank you so much, which is great.
But let's talk about the songs. How about that?
Yeah.
Let's go down the soundtrack. This is something we didn't talk about talking about.
No.
But the first song on the album is the, I can't remember the exact title.
It's Goodbye, Eddie. Goodbye,
Goodbye. Eddie. Goodbye. That's right. The Juicy Fruits, which in this one, Harold Oblong is singing lead, I think, to start with. No, it's Archie Hahn.
It's Hahn.
Archie Hahn. That's right. He's singing lead in this one. And that's cool because each time the Juicy Fruits change from Juicy Fruits to Beach Bums to Undeads, a different one becomes the lead singer.
Right.
But yeah, this is a retro 50s kind of tune. And it's a cool song, you know? It does exactly what it's supposed to do to set up the movie and the way the nostalgia culture or whatever at the time.
Yeah. Well, it reminds me, I should point out, that you know you're in for a good time at the beginning of Famine of the Paradise because it opens with a voiceover from none other than Mr. Rod Serling.
The Rods are uncredited in the film, but yeah, Rod Serling gives you the opening voiceover.
And Rod Serling explains that Swan, who is the music mogul, has been sort of the architect of popular music for the past however many years, how he brought the Beatles to America, and did he say something about Elvis and Ed Sullivan or
something like that,
And so as we talked about later in the movie, it's established that there's a sort of Dorian Gray angle with Swan, which explains why he's been around so long to do all these things and doesn't look all that old. But Mr. Serling tells us that Swan's latest venture in music,
the Juicy Fruits,
right, is the nostalgia movement of the 70s, where he's got this group, the Juicy Fruits, who are doing a sort of 50s throwback nostalgia thing. So,
and then when he hears Winslow's "The Music, Philbin, listen to the music," the Juicy Fruits change from the 50s greaser sha-na-na
right
type thing to more of a, they become the Beach Bums and they go into the surf music, the Beach Boys.
And now we're in the, I guess in the 60s.
Jeffrey Komanar.
Right.
Becomes the lead singer.
And then later in the movie, once Beef is introduced, the Beach Bums are rechristened the Undeads.
Alice Cooper Kiss Anybody?
Yeah, and we're very much back in the 70s now with a shock rock style.
Yeah.
Band with face makeup and the whole deal. That reminds me, though, you mentioned Sha-na-na.
Yeah.
In the featurette, they do say that Sha-na-na was supposed to have played the Juicy Fruits originally.
Oh, man.
Yeah. And
that would have been awesome.
Fell through for, I'm forgetting why, even though I just watched that featurette, man. And they ended up going the way they did instead.
But yeah. Going back to the songs, we're going to take the songs one by one. You get to, Winslow does,
Old Emotions.
Old Emotions. Once you get to Upholstery, it becomes, you hear the same song repeatedly later on, but done different styles. He changes it from a surf rock beach song to more of a 70s rock anthem than to a ballad. But it's the same piece of music. It's just played a different way.
It's a great scene. We talked about the Juicy Fruits performance of Goodbye, Eddie, Goodbye, which opens the movie, and then we go up into the booth, and that's where Philbin gets his monologue, and he's sort of talking to the camera. But that's one half of the frame, and the other half of the frame, looking out the one-way glass down at the floor where the Juicy Fruits have been performing the whole time Philbin's giving his monologue.
Winslow's down there setting up,
right? It's another one of those great De Palma-ish visuals. And then eventually, you know, Winslow starts to play. Now, Bill Findlay, not a singer.
No, not by any stretch.
But Paul Williams worked with him to train him to sing the songs that he needs to sing in the movie, which I guess is just the one, really. He gets a little bit of business.
Well, you know, he sings Meet the Devil.
Right. And he gets a little bit of business with Jessica Harper in the audition.
Mm-hmm.
Just a little bit.
Yeah.
But Old Emotions, he performs just voice and piano. And I want to point this out.
Yeah.
Now, on the soundtrack album, you get two versions of Old Emotions.
Yeah.
One is, as we hear it in the movie, which is Bill Findlay singing it over piano. The other is Paul Williams performing it with more, with a denser arrangement, more instruments, more accompaniment.
Yeah, a complete song.
And you and I have debated this before, because you hate the Bill Findlay Old Emotions.
I don't hate it. I may have at one time. It's grown on me. but he, like you said, he is not the same, the vocalist that Paul Williams is. But continue.
Well, I was just going to say that you don't like it as much as I do. I like it a lot. Obviously, he's not a trained singer. He doesn't have the ideal voice, but there's a rawness in that performance that I really enjoy.
An honesty to it.
Yeah. Now, the Paul Williams take on it is very, very good. And Paul Williams has a great voice, and it's a great performance of the song, but it's much slicker.
Oh, yeah.
It's very 70s, very, very produced.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And it occurred to me that how well that represents the movie in a way.
Yeah, it does.
Right?
Well, you know, and at that point, that is the Phantom's singing voice.
Yeah.
Paul Williams becomes the Phantom's singing voice because the accident that destroys his face, destroys his vocal cords, and he can talk with a raspy growl with the box that Swan gives him, but he plugs him into the console and uses filters, Dolby's, and all that for him to sing. And as he's tweaking the voice, it starts to sound more and more like Paul Williams. Now, is that Swan being vain and making it sound like Swan?
Yes.
or is, because Swan doesn't sing in the movie at all now, or is it just, we're going to make Paul Williams be the voice of the Phantom, you know?
Well, you might call that intertext.
Yeah. I think generally it's assumed that it's Swan being vain and I'm going to make you sound like me.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
But
because when it finally sounds completely like Paul Williams, he says, perfect.
Yeah. But we're back at the Bill Finley song there, Old Emotions. And the next one coming up, I do believe is Upholstery, right?
Yeah, Upholstery is
No. Get to Meet the Devil is the next song, that little snippet.
Yeah, the fragment. And
yeah.
Then I believe it is Upholstery is next.
Which is the Beach Boys song, as we'd said. And Phantom has his revenge, and the Beach Bums become the Undeads.
Before that, though, we get the Phantom song, Beauty and the Beast. And
oh, yeah. Great song.
Is it Special to Me? Is that the name of that one? The audition song that...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's her pony dance.
The pony dance.
And I've got the DVD of They Made It Phantompalooza. Then I don't think you've seen that yet.
I think I have. Have we watched it?
Yeah. Okay. I don't know if it's on that or if it's in a picture I saw, but when they introduce her at the dais there, she stands up and does a couple of the pony arm moves. So she knows. And if you do not understand what we're talking about, the pony dance, you've obviously not seen the movie or that scene, and you must go out right now and get it and watch it.
I think this episode ought to be posted with a disclaimer that says you really need to have watched the movie before you listen to this.
Hey, maybe this will spark someone who's never seen it and wants to watch it, and our job is done.
Gentle listener, if you have the patience to sit through all of this thus far, even if you've never seen, particularly if you've never seen Phantom of the Paradise, bless you. Bless you and keep you. And I wish I had a fraction of your patience. But anyway.
But back to the music.
Yes.
But you get Beef's rendition, actually Garrett Graham's rendition, because Beef's singing voice was by, I think, was it Ray Stark? Garrett Graham did not sing any of the songs, but when it's just them doing dialogue and the rehearsing, he does wail and belt out, what is the song?
Oh, Old Souls.
Oh, Old Souls. Yeah, he's doing a hard rock version of Old Souls, which is very bizarre after hearing the final version. Yeah. And then we go on to, what's the next song after that? Commodore?
Life at Last. Or
Somebody Super Like You.
Somebody Super Like You / Life at Last.
Yeah, which is really a cool combination of two songs together. I was listening to the soundtrack driving over here tonight, actually. I hadn't listened to it in a while. And I think I replayed those two back to back again. Then Beef gets electrified by a giant neon lightning bolt. And we get Old Souls.
Right.
Jessica Harper's Tour de Force. And you really get to hear her pipes in this one and see what kind of range she's got.
It's
man.
Beautiful, beautiful ballad in the writing. I mean,
oh, yeah.
It's just amazing.
It's a beautiful song. It's written well. It's performed well. It's just a great, great song. And her range is incredible. Amazing vocalist. They couldn't have picked anybody better to do that part. But anyway, you go on to the end of the movie and we get...
It's just it just repeats Old Souls, right?
Oh, probably.
In different versions like you were talking about before.
Actually, that's it. There's no other really performed songs.
No, not until
in the movie. And then over the closing credits, you get probably about my favorite song in the movie, The Hell of It.
On the featurette, Mr. Williams points out that the hell of it was written for a scene they never shot. It was meant to be played over Beef's funeral.
Wow.
Right.
It makes sense, at least in the lyrics.
During or immediately after the funeral, there was supposed to be this procession of people that would begin to dance in this very, as he described it, Fellini-esque dance. Uh-huh. And that's what the dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun part was written for.
Wow.
And then later in the song, when you hear the tapping, as if someone tap dancing, uh-huh. A little girl was supposed to be tap dancing on Beef's casket.
Wow, that's awesome.
And for whatever reason, they never shot that scene, so they just used the hell of it over the end of the movie.
But yeah, that is that's probably about my favorite song. Don't get me wrong, I love all the songs in the movie. That is probably about my favorite song, and it doesn't get as much attention because it is over the closing credits.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of another thing that you'll appreciate,
yes, sir,
from the featurette, Mr. Williams points out that the mask that Swan is wearing during the wedding scene,
uh-huh,
towards the end, was his life mask. From Battle for the Planet of the Apes.
I knew you were going to say that. Wow, that's cool.
And he says how he had lost a bunch of weight since then, uh-huh, which is why the life mask is pudgier.
It does. It does look pudgier, yeah. Wow, that's cool. Yeah, that is cool. I almost wondered about that. That's pretty cool. Now, here's an aside. Talking about the soundtrack and the film itself, not a great critical success, not a great financial success when it came out.
No.
Except in Winnipeg, Canada. I believe it's Winnipeg was the town.
I believe you are correct.
The soundtrack went gold, stayed on the charts for a year. The movie played in a theater, I think, for close to a year, if not a year. It's still hugely popular in that one town in Canada. And every year they have the Phantom of the Paradise convention there. Go figure. Who the hell would have thought some little town in Canada? I don't know. It could be a big town. I've never been there. But this little movie, this cult film, hugely popular in this one town. I would love to go to this convention, though, at some point.
Definitely.
A few years ago, and talking about the DVD earlier, they had the entire cast there. And it's before William Finley passed away. All the principals, all the Juicy Fruits, and they performed. They performed all the songs from the movie, which had to have been a sight to see. There's some of it on the DVD. You don't get to see Paul Williams performing, I guess contractual issues, management or whatever. You get a little bit, by two-thirds of Jessica Harper doing Old Souls, and it's incredible. The Juicy Fruits and Beef singing songs they never sang, or at least Beef never sang it, but Garrett Graham doing it and pulling it off, making and being really, you know, funny about it, and the Juicy Fruits, Undeads, Beach Bums just going for broke. Haven't been together or done anything since the movie came out, and it is a joy to watch. Plus the interviews on it of the cast and everybody. I think there's a entire cast interview, and then there's one with just Garrett Graham and William Finley, which is just gold.
I think it was also somewhat successful in France or maybe just in Paris. I don't know.
Yeah.
There were two places, Winnipeg and I believe it was Paris, where it was successful, but not on the scale of Winnipeg. Winnipeg is the capital of the Phantom fan world.
It's bizarre. You know, you're talking about in France too. I think it's France. You see the French movie poster show up on eBay quite a bit, mm-hmm, and it's kind of cool. It's really the one that I've seen. It's like the black and white. But there were two. If you don't know, there's two posters that were released for the movie, and one is a picture of the Phantom in black and white standing up from the keyboards, and it says he sold his soul for rock and roll, Phantom of the Paradise. And the other is a painted horror-like poster. You see part of his scarred face, and God, who was that done by? I want to say it was like Neil Adams or somebody that I found out not too long ago. It was some, I think, comic book artist that I really like. I'll have to post that on the Facebook page because it's my mind's a blank right now about that. But the two posters, they're great-looking posters, both of them. But the Italian one, is it Italian or French? Now I'm questioning that. We'll say French. Is the black and white shot, but it's got like neon colors washed over it. If you haven't seen it, it's kind of a neat image.
I haven't seen it.
It shows up on eBay from time to time. It's not really that expensive, I don't think, from what I remember. But I believe the other two, the American posters, have gone up in value quite a bit since I got my copies many, many years ago. Memorabilia on Phantom. There wasn't hardly anything at the time. I managed to pick up the press book, which has stills, the lobby card set, both posters, the ad slick sheets, and the press book. In addition to the, I think, the soundtrack album, there was a poster that wasn't the movie poster that was sold in stores. I have yet to come across one, but it's the art that's on the soundtrack album. I don't think there was much else. I mean, I don't think there was any giveaways at the theater that I know of. I don't think there were any buttons or anything like that.
No. Well, I think from what I believe is that it did well for its LA opening, but very poorly for its New York opening.
Yeah.
Just sort of sank like a stone after that. So there wasn't a lot of work put into promoting it around the country.
So anything that you can find on Phantom of the Paradise that is vintage, that's not new, snap it up if you can find it. I'm a nut for memorabilia and movie promotional items. So anything I can find, I always try to pick up. In recent years, they have put out quite a few things. There's a lot of cool t-shirts by different companies out there. And was it Mediacom did Medicom did that 12-inch action figure, which I have. Thank you very much. Beautiful figure. You can move the visor on the helmet and you see the scarred face and he comes with the plunger and everything. It's a great figure. I don't think there's anything else really out there. Wait, there might be a few things here and there. You have to look and see.
So I feel like we've barely scratched this. I feel like over the course of this, we've opened up several avenues of conversation that we could spend the next Lord knows how long going down. However, we are at the pre-editing anyway. We are at the 1 hour 40 minute mark, so we should probably wrapping this puppy dog up.
Okay, well, how about closing remarks?
So for closing, I'm going to put you on the spot.
Okay.
What I would call the two big cult musicals from the 70s.
Okay.
And I know I'm discounting some other things here, but I think everyone would agree.
Xanadu was in the 80s, Tony.
Phantom of the Paradise and the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Yes, indeed.
Now, you are known for your association with the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, a little bit.
So here's me putting you on the spot. Rocky, okay. Phantom, Deathmatch, who wins?
Well, you know, that's a tough one. That is a tough one because I have a strong connection to both of them for lots of different reasons. Yeah. Oh, man, that is tough. Personally or just objectively?
Take it however you want.
Okay, honestly, I would say, if you want to say Deathmatch, I would say Rocky Horror would win because of its cult status and following and the success it's had over the years. Phantom, on the other hand, okay, here you go. Rocky Horror is no longer a cult film. How about that? It stopped being a cult film, and people can argue till they're blue in the face with me on this, but I stand behind this. Phyllis and I have had this discussion numerous times with people. Rocky Horror Picture Show stopped being a cult film some years ago. It has become a mainstream film. When a film gets a cult film, when it gets shown on television repeatedly, that it was never, ever shown on television or released on DVD or VHS, any memorabilia, like I was talking about before, was really hard to come by and hard to find. You had to seek it out. And if you found it, it was like finding gold. And there was a certain group of people. What makes a cult film, or makes a cult anything, that followed the film around, went to it every weekend, because that's the only place you could see it, was at the theater. And it was a sense of community. It was, this private, cool thing that you and a handful of other people understood and loved and got into and was a part of your life. Rocky Horror isn't that anymore. It's mainstream. Everybody and their brother knows about it. Everybody and their brother can quote a song from it. When you can find memorabilia in the mall, plenty. Action figures, t-shirts, whatever else. There's tons of other stuff. I've bought some of it myself. I mean, you know, it is when they do takeoffs on it on Glee, when they do takeoffs on it on, what was that? Cold Case Files did an episode about Rocky Horror. It was a TV show. I don't know if it's still on now. It's a mainstream film. It's not a cult film anymore. It used to be, and it's still cool, but it was a lot cooler when it was a cult film. Phantom of the Paradise, I do believe, is still a cult film. Yeah, you might find a t-shirt. You got to hunt for them though online. You're not going to see stuff in the mall. The Medicom figure is not something that shows up everywhere. It was a limited edition, limited number. They're not made anymore. You know, it's a hard to find piece. The film itself, not everybody knows of it. Not everybody knows about it. But you see little kids in Rocky Horror costumes.
I think you make a strong case. I think I must agree with your assessment of the cult status of Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Yeah.
I would say if you measure it by Rocky's standing, mm-hmm. then there's no contest. Rocky wins the match. Uh-huh. However, as a piece of cinema, Phantom of the Paradise knocks Rocky on its ass. Takes his lunch money, laughs in its face.
Calls it a bitch.
Lets it cry for 10, 15 minutes, and then finally kills it and ends the death match. Okay, that's what happens there.
I can agree with you on that.
I'd also like to say that I think I agree with your points.
Mm-hmm.
I don't agree that you can really compare them based on their following, and I would argue that Rocky's following has far more to do with the ritual that people built around
than it does with
anything that goes on in that movie as far as the content really.
No, you're 100% right with that.
There's a lot of stuff in Rocky that I like, but
I'll get on my soapbox again about Rocky Horror.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people out there that are involved with it that are in shadow cast. I hate that term, but they use that nowadays, shadow cast. That perform the movie like I did for a number of years in front of the screen, and especially people involved with it these days don't really like the movie itself.
Yeah.
They like, you say, they like the ritual, they like the spectacle, they be part of the circus around it, which is fine. But when I got into it back in the day, if you liked it, you liked the movie, you liked the actors in the movie, you liked the music, you liked everything involved with it, the spectacle and everything. And that's what drew you to it. Nowadays, it seems to be people go to see the circus, they go to see the spectacle, and they want to be part of that little spectacle, and they don't really know anything about the movie itself. I will venture to say it is a perfect movie for what it is supposed to be. It's not high art. It is a 70s rock musical satire of 50s B-movies.
Yeah.
And in and of that, it's perfect.
Yeah.
You know, it's made cheaply. It was made quickly, those movies were made back then, mm-hmm. but with a 70s... the, you know, sexual generation, you know, free love generation, rock, 70s rock and roll bent to it.
Yeah. You're talking about how it was meant to function.
Mm-hmm.
And taken on its own, it functions in that capacity very well, mm-hmm. but that function is lost on much of the audience.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You and I have stood in packed houses for Rocky Horror. And I've said to you, no one in this place other than you and I knows who Michael Rennie is or who Anne Francis is or what Rocky's creation scene is meant to be an homage to. Nobody here.
Yeah.
And of course, there's a certain degree of speculation in that, but I'm pretty safe. I would put my money down on that bet. You know what I mean?
I'd stand behind. I'd put some money down with you there. And another thing, too, now the difference between Rocky and Phantom is Rocky was originally conceived and written as a play, and they adapted the play to the film. Whereas Phantom was just written as a film. So they were adapting the scenes of the play to the film. Whereas the Phantom was coming off the script, written for the screen. And it is, cinematically, it's beautifully shot. It's a great film. It's almost like, even though they are both cult rock and roll musicals, it's like apples and oranges when you start breaking it down and thinking about it. Each one has a strong appeal to me for lots of different reasons. Rocky Horror, I was a part of that whole thing for, God knows, about 19 years. And it was a huge part of my life when I was doing it. And I still love it. You know, the music and the film and everything about it, you know, then. I still love it as much now as I did then. But Phantom is a film that sticks with me for different reasons. And even though Richard O'Brien wrote some great catchy songs from Rocky Horror, Paul Williams is just a much better songwriter in general. And the Phantom songs, like you were saying about Old Souls earlier, I think it's just a beautiful song. You know, it's not a catchy number you're going to, you know, just hum and sing, and you're going to you're gonna feel something from it.
Yeah, those songs all, well, I mean, you could maybe make an exception for Upholstery or something like that, but those songs, for the most part, all work outside of the context of the movie.
Yeah, but those specific ones were written for specific scenes in the movie, so they serve their purpose and to a T.
Right.
You know, and to write them, I was thinking about this on the way over here, too, listening to Upholstery. It's like, what was the process of writing that, you know? It was the whole process thinking, okay, I've got this one song is going to be a theme throughout the film and has to be changed to suit the scene of the film and who's singing it. Did he sit down and write which one came first, you know?
Yeah, I don't know.
And then did he sit down and go, okay, I'm going to write this song, okay, this beach song, this Beach Boys song. Now, what? Okay, surfboards, girls, swimming, cars, okay, car culture, okay. You know, what was the process of having the song be Upholstery? It could have been anything. It could have been tires. It could have been hubcaps. When did Upholstery come in?
Hubcaps.
You know, but it works. It's beautiful. It's mastery of songwriting. You know, pick on me for using that term all you want, but I think it's just ingenious the way he continues with the same song, changing, altering it throughout to suit the needs of, you know, what was asked for in the film. No, Upholstery is not as intense a song as, say, Beauty and the Beast or Old Souls, but it's perfect for what it was supposed to be right then.
Well, yeah, all I was saying is that if you take an Old Souls or an Old Emotions or one of those other ones and you stick it on the radio as a single without explaining that it's from a movie,
yeah,
it works and no one's going to think anything of it.
Mm-hmm.
If you take Upholstery and stick that on the radio as a single, people are going to be like,
what the hell is this?
Right, which is true of all the songs in Rocky, really.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, they all are specifically... Each one of those songs in that movie are specifically geared to a character or scene.
Yeah.
In Rocky. On their own, if you're not a fan, you've never heard them, yeah, they really won't make any sense when you hear them. But yeah, so the winner in the death match, probably Phantom. Each one for different reasons. I mean, it depends on what angle you're coming from. Both of them are favorites of mine and always will be.
And on that note, we should say goodnight.
Good night.